Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Bring us in, babe.
Welcome to Coco Caliente. So a little baby update. I am feeling great.
How far along are you now?
27 weeks.
27 weeks.
Yeah, 27 weeks. So basically in the third trimester.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Baby's kicking a lot. And
Nicole's bumping.
Yeah.
She's bumping.
And it's just peeing a lot, but feeling great.
Looking great too.
Scared to, like, just like thinking about, this is when the night, like the dreams and nightmares come, like, oh my gosh, because you feel like you could go in labor at this point. This baby's like almost fully developed, and it's insane that like it's he's a baby.
There's a human in
yes.
you. There's a human there. I think it's.
I asked Victor the other day. I'm like, "Are you jealous? I get to carry the baby." I'm like, "He's gonna always feel closer to me," which is not probably true.
You're like a seahorse, where you actually create it and then you can pass it to me, and then I carry it.
Is that what seahorses do?
Yeah.
Oh my god, I remember you telling me that. That's amazing.
Something like that. People think that they got pregnant, but no, they transfer the egg to the. I think that's how that works. They transfer the egg to the dad, and then he carries all the eggs, and they come out of his pouch.
Oh, that's so cute.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
It'd be nice to just like take a little bit of a break and have a glass of wine. But besides that, I'm
doing
well.
Isn't it crazy to think that back in the day, less knowledgeable about these things, right? Science and doctors and stuff. Mm-hmm. And people just smoked cigarettes, drank wine, just
they
do
all
whatever.
Turned out fine.
Most of them. Yeah, thank God.
Well, my grandma, she had 15 kids and she was talking about it the other day. She had 10 boys. And she said like, it doesn't register in my mind until she says it. No ultrasound ever. No, like, doctor really appointment at all. You just, like, are pregnant.
All right, you're pregnant. And as long as you're feeling good, you're good.
You're pregnant, and then until you deliver, nothing.
That's crazy.
Like, 15 times.
Imagine, like, at that time it was normal, but imagine... now doing that, like the anxiety that you would have, like, this is everything.
Yeah, every morning I wake up, I'm like, did I sleep on him wrong? Is he okay? Is he moving? Like, please kick.
Like 9 months of not knowing.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And just, I mean, she was a dairy farmer, so she was just milking cows, carrying heavy stuff.
Out
doing
with the animals.
All by herself, because my grandpa worked in the city for a car company. And doing all of that while being pregnant. So whenever I get a little bit stressed, I think about what my grandma went through and like how she did so well with, I mean, she still was working very hard. So I'm like, okay, Nicole, you need to like chill a little bit.
And speaking of babies, this aligns perfectly with our guest today.
Yeah, we have Tina on. She's a doctor. She's very knowledgeable. We're very excited for you to hear this discussion. I think it's very insightful. So enjoy.
Hello, hello, hello. Is this Miss Tina?
Yeah, it is. Is this Victor?
Oh, you know me.
Well, I wrote your names down on a pad of paper in front of me, so I would know who to say hello to.
That's very doctor of you, being prepared.
I try.
Do you prefer being called Dr.
Tina is fine.
Okay, Tina, thank you.
I'm a mom in the trenches. You know, like, I just picked up my kid from school. I'm trying to figure out what to make for dinner. Just pausing for an interview in the middle of it all.
Oh, well. And we've had a pretty crazy day ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so now we're doing our interview of you. So,
well, congratulations. What does your baby do?
July 28th.
Oh my gosh, it's coming up so fast. How exciting.
It is. It's coming up really quick. I'm about to start in the nursery. We just had an appointment today for like a checkup, and everything seemed really good. So yeah, it's going to be here before we know it.
So exciting. And where do y'all live? What state are you in?
Michigan.
Oh, that's right. That's in my notes too. Okay.
Are you in California?
I am. I'm in Pasadena, right by the Rose Bowl.
You know, a very off topic, Nicole and I just for the first time saw the documentary, mm-hmm. Fire in Paradise. Is that what it is?
Well, I haven't seen that.
You haven't seen it. So it's about you know, obviously it's about the fire that was in Paradise, California. Well, it did more than that, but just completely leveled Paradise. And I what an eye opener that was. So whenever you get a chance on Netflix.
Yeah, I wrote it down. I'll definitely. Someone also just told me about a great documentary called Seaspiracy. It's about
gosh.
Have you guys seen it?
Yes.
Is it good?
Yes. Okay. I'm a documentary fiend. Yeah, that's my name.
That one's very eye-opening about things that I didn't know about. I didn't know.
It transitions you into the commercial fishing
side of
things where that seems to be the biggest problem.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah, so it was...
Oh, it's going to make me sad, though. I'm so tender-hearted about animals. I know it's going to make me so sad.
Yeah, Nicole even has a hard time watching, like, just the regular BBC, like Planet Earth stuff, because they show like you know Mother Nature and you know on survival Instagram, of the fittest.
I like on Instagram, I'll follow like a cute animal page, and then all of a sudden it'll show like this lion with a baby deer in its mouth. I'm like, unfollow. Like it's too much. Like I want to see the cute stuff, I don't want to see that, and I'll like cry about it.
I know. It's me so too. Bad. I get sad. Mm-hmm. I love like antiquing and thrifting and like finding treasures, and if I even just see like any kind of antlers or horn, like I'm like, oh, I can't, it's too sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's and another one, not to bombard you, but do you have or you have somebody that or you have HBO? Do you have HBO Max at all?
We do. Uh-huh.
Exterminate the Brutes. Oh my gosh. I mean, one of the best quotes from that, and he said something to the effect of, history is written by those who win. And
that's a good quote.
Yes. Yeah, so it gives you a really deep understanding of history from another perspective, and it's still facts.
I love it.
It's just from another point of view.
I love it.
Back on topic, and also very random as well. When you became a doctor, you went to Baylor, right, first?
Undergrad, yep.
And then where did you go for your graduate?
Then I got married at 22. So I'm so now young. 49, which means I've been married for 27 years. And my boys are now 21. One just turned 18 yesterday, and then my baby's 14. Three boys.
Wow.
So I got married, and my husband had an offer to go teach and get his PhD for free at University of Kentucky. So he moved to UK, to University of Kentucky, and I got my master's degree there. And then I had a baby, and then I started my PhD work at USC and kept having babies as I was finishing my PhD program. So,
oh wow, did you always want to be a PhD?
No.
Is that it just kind of fell on your
and
lap?
I never meant to write books either. my plan was to be a high school English teacher because I love teaching and I love literature. I married an English my husband became an English professor, so I got it sort of that way. But no, I ended up going to getting my master's in social work. I always wanted to really invest my life in people, and particularly children.
Mm-hmm.
And my plan was always, from the time I was 5 years old, to be a stay-at-home mom. And so when my husband got the job out here in California, where my family was from, I was so excited to move back here. We couldn't afford to live on an English professor's salary. So he was like, you have to go back to work. And I was like, that's not the plan. And he said, I know, you got to change the plan. So I was like, well, look, if I have to work, I'm going to go get a PhD really fast so that I can be a professor, because that'll be really conducive hours to me being home with the boys.
Yes.
And so I had an 18-month-old. I started the program, and I got pregnant almost toward the end and had a baby right after I finished my coursework and started to work on my dissertation. And then I had another one as I was defending my dissertation. And in the process, I came across this field of interpersonal neurobiology. And I was like, all of this stuff about the brain, parents need to know about it. So I was like, I've got to start sharing this with parents. And so instead of going the research professor route, I started teaching parenting classes and doing parenting groups, and then did clinical work with families, you know, as a mental health provider, parenting consults and all that, and doing therapy with kids, and then started writing books. And now that's a weird job. I have a weird job of writing books and speaking about them. And so, yeah, I just kept following what lit me up, you know, what really felt important. And it turned out to be a pretty decent career. It turned out.
That's so fascinating. This episode is sponsored by SESH. That's S-E-S-H. Traditional therapy can be expensive, and to many of us, it's inaccessible. Hundreds of dollars a month to text with a counselor? No thanks. SESH offers a safe space for group support where you can connect with other people in similar situations, all led by expert therapists. SESH is the leading mental health app for accessible group support, facilitated by diverse, licensed therapists who are experts in their field.
Each SESH is a 60-minute online group support session, and it's led by an experienced therapist with specific specialty, and each session has a maximum of 14 participants, and it's only $60 per month for unlimited group sessions with licensed therapists. And it's recommended by therapists, mental health experts, and offers a cost-effective way to meet your mental health goals. Each new user receives a free 2-week trial. So the first step, go to seshtherapy.com today and download the SESH app in the App Store. Again, that's seshtherapy.com. SESH is a mental health care made easy, and we thank them for sponsoring this podcast.
I'm just curious, what was your dissertation about?
My dissertation was on this longitudinal, my whole focus in my whole PhD program was on child rearing theory and child rearing research. But there was a particular data set that one of my professors had where she had studied, she had all this longitudinal research on these girls who had been sexually abused, and they had done 20 years of data analysis on the factors of the girls, like the control group and the girls that had been sexually abused. But no one had ever looked at all the data they had collected on the mothers of these girls. And so I analyzed all the parenting aspects of what made these girls more or less vulnerable to sexual abuse. And then I also dove really deep into attachment science, which has still ended up being one of the most important things I ever talk about. And the book that I wrote with Dan Siegel, right before The Bottom Line for Baby that came out, The Power of Showing Up, dives deep into this over 50 years of research, cross-cultural research, that shows that the best predictor for how well kids turn out across everything we measure is that they have what's called secure attachment with at least one person. And it's totally different from what attachment parenting is. I don't know if you guys have been reading books about different kind of approaches to parenting, but it's really it's not at all what attachment parenting books are about. It's really under the umbrella of developmental psychology, which shows, like, really as primates, we are wired as infant primates to get close to our caregivers when we're in distress. And so it's been a really kind of great timing with this book coming out 2 months before the pandemic hit, because we have this inborn system as primates that allows us to be more resilient and that allows our brains to develop in the most optimal ways. And that is that when we are in distress, to get close to our attachment figures, who then connect with us and protect us. And really the main job of primate caregivers is to show up in the moments when our young are in distress and see and respond to their needs quickly and sensitively to build that trust. And really what that looks like is, or what that really means is, we are regulating not only their emotional states, like, right, they get scared and they cry and we comfort them, but also regulating their physiological states. You know, when they're stressed, we soothe them. When they're, you know, when they're really little infants, even just states of being wet or hungry or those kinds of things are physiologically stressful. Mm-hmm. And so we soothe the state. So in The Power of Showing Up, we talk about the four S's of helping our children develop secure attachment with us, which are safe, which obviously is protecting them from harm and making repairs with them when we mess up as parents and become kind of the source of their fear or the source of unpredictability when we yell or get, you know, reactive. Scene where we tune into what they're feeling, we see them for who they are, and we respond in sensitive ways, tuning into their internal landscape. So it's really about seeing the mind behind their behaviors. Mm-hmm. And then soothed, and that's showing up and comforting and nurturing when they need it. And then not perfectly, but when they have repeated experiences of feeling safe, seen, and soothed, they develop that fourth S of security, which really means that they've had enough predictable experiences where their brain has wired to know that if they have a need, we're going to show up for them. And then over time, their brain develops the capacity to show up for themselves, to keep themselves safe, to see and understand themselves, to soothe themselves, and then to securely know that relationships are reliable. And then they can provide that same kind of security in their friendships and their romantic relationships, and then as future parents too. So it's really one of the most important things I talk about, I think.
Yeah. And so that begs the question, what type of long-term, effects do you see in children that they lack that either one part of it or it entirely?
So what happens then is, so just like there is a secure pattern of attachment, that's what we just talked about, mm-hmm. there are what we call insecure patterns of attachment. And there are different versions of that. One is where you kind of grow up in an emotional desert. Your parent doesn't really respond to your emotions. You're left alone to deal with things. And in fact, you know, we have this laboratory procedure that has been done for decades now that's sort of the gold standard, called the strange situation. And this is a laboratory procedure that's done on 12 to 18 month olds. And what's fascinating is, you know, children are incredibly brilliant, and they, by 12 months of age, already have wired in their brains, based on these experiences, how to get the best from their parents. So if you grew up where your parent doesn't really respond to your emotional needs, or when you're in distress and you ask for them, if it doesn't go so well the way they respond, then you learn even by 12 months of age to stop asking. So in this procedure, one of the things they do is they ask the attachment figure to get up and leave the baby in the room. It's a safe room, but they get up and leave. And what happens is babies who have secure attachment to their caregiver will cry a lot. You know, they're like, wait a minute, I don't like you mm-hmm. leaving, but they don't get stressed out. Like their cortisol levels don't elevate. They don't stress out because it's almost like they know, mm-hmm. hey, I'm going to cry and don't worry, because she's just going to come right back.
Yeah.
Like, I've got this, right? But the baby with an insecure pattern of attachment will either be, so in one case, the baby is really stressed, but they don't reach for the parent. They don't cry. They don't give indications that they're in stress, because they already have learned that it doesn't go so well when they have an emotional need like that.
That would be sad.
I know, isn't it? So that's actually called avoidant attachment. And then another type of insecure attachment is called anxious ambivalent attachment. And this is where you have a really unpredictable caregiver. So you have no idea if they're going to show up for you or not, or if they're going to meet your need or not. They're just really unreliable. So in the strange situation, these 12-month-olds cry a lot, typically when their parent leaves. But the parent is typically unsuccessful at soothing them. And the baby becomes very clingy, because they're like, I better hang on to you and keep showing you I have needs, because maybe then you'll stay with me. Mm. So there's this anxiousness and ambivalence about whether or not they can rely on the caregiver. Whereas the last one, the baby avoids that connection because they know it doesn't go so well. And then the other, there's three really patterns of insecure attachment. And this one is the hardest one to talk about. And it's called disorganized attachment. And this would be what we see in more extreme cases of abuse and neglect, where if you have, as a primate, your primary drive instinctually is, when you are in distress, when you are terrified, when you are in pain, you have this biological drive that says, go to your caregiver to be connected and protected. But if your caregiver is the source of your terror, the source of your pain, you also have a biological circuit that says, get the hell away from what's dangerous.
Oh.
So it actually creates disorganization in the brain and how to even process their behaviors and emotions. And so anyway, those are the insecure patterns of attachment. But I do have to say, after talking about all of those hard things, you know, the outcomes, or let me say this, attachment research is so full of hope. I mean, here are some of the just broad brush hope messages. One is, it's never too late. Okay. History is not destiny. And I mean that in two ways. In one way, what I mean is, the best predictor for how well we as parents are able to provide our children with this most important thing we do, secure attachment, is not dependent on whether or not we received it from our parents. And thank God, because about 35% of us had a more insecure pattern of attachment with our parents. So the best predictor for us being able to do this is that we have reflected on those experiences relationally and made sense of them. So instead of running from our past and being like, I don't know, it doesn't matter, it's the past, or instead of being flooded by it all the time where we're triggered all the time, we can look at it objectively and say, gosh, my parents didn't really show up for me a lot of times, and I was left on my own, and that was really hard, and here's how it impacted me, and here's the kind of parent I want to be. So really just shining the light of awareness and making sense of our story is the best predictor for how well we're able to provide this secure attachment. So history is not destiny based on our own attachment upbringing, but it's also not destiny if a parent is listening to this, no matter how old your kids are, even if they're teenagers or even young adults, it's never too late, because this wiring that we're talking about is based on repeated experiences. So as soon as we start providing more positive experiences, our children's brains start changing. So it's never too late. Once we start in everyday moments, helping our kids feel safe, helping them feel seen, helping soothe them, especially when they're in distress, this is what starts moving that attachment more towards positive. And then finally, the other huge hopeful message is that parents can mess up all the time and still have kids who are securely attached to them. So there's just tons of room as long as we make a repair.
Is that just because that's just parents, because it's a genetic thing, because we are wired to, they're our caregiver, they're our trust person, blood, you know, because I guess what I'm getting at is that wouldn't necessarily work for somebody that's not your caregiver outside in a separate relationship, right? You could just never.
Yeah, it's different.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, it's different. That attachment relationship is not only unique in
exclusive. The word I'm looking for.
Yeah. But keep in mind, children can have lots of attachment figures, right? Mm-hmm. And ideally they do, right? My boys have secure attachment to me and my husband and lots of grandparents and even my best friends, you know, my best friend, you know, she shows up for them like a parent does. So we really want that. But you know, what's so great about this is that when we mess up as parents, and I know it's hard to imagine when you're now imagining this like perfect baby and you're so in love with your baby and you haven't yet been in the full on trenches, but sometimes, and I'm just telling you the now, you will talk to and treat your child in ways you would never imagine or allow anyone else to treat or talk to your child. And part of that is because we're human and children can be very difficult and they, you know, it can be exhausting. And so sometimes as parents, we flip our lids and I tell a story in No Drama Discipline, which is a book that I wrote with Dan Siegel. That's a pretty radical different way to think about the point and purpose of discipline and how to be an effective disciplinarian, knowing how the brain works. And in that book that we both tell stories about times we flipped our lid as parents, and I tell a story about when my 3-year-old kept sticking his tongue out at me, I threatened to remove a body part. I told him to stuck his tongue out one more time, I was going to remove it. And then I often tell a story about the 3 boys. I was playing Yahtzee with them and they were fighting and things kept escalating and I was exhausted. And I ended up starting out being really immature. And then I ended up yelling at them and throwing the dice across the room. Now we refer to this as the Yahtzee incident. But after moments like that, the key is, you know, when we become unpredictable as parents, and that could be aimed at our children, like I just described, or if the two of you guys get into a fight and start screaming at each other, that can be really frightening for children. Or if you lose your cool doing road rage or whatever it is, when we become really reactive as parents, our children can't rely on us in those moments to be regulated enough to make sure they're protected and to regulate their emotions. So the key is that when we have those moments, we become predictable immediately by repairing with them. So even if our kids are like, oh gosh, mom's kind of mean right now, and that was really scary the way she just yelled at us, and that feels really bad, I'm not too worried about it because I know in a couple minutes she's going to come make things right with me. So there becomes a predictability even in the face of the unpredictability. And when we make these mistakes, as long as we repair, and I mean simply saying, guys, I did not handle that well. I'm so sorry. I got angry and I yelled and I really wish I had done that differently. Will you forgive me? And maybe even can I have a do-over, right? Mm-hmm. It's just a simple way of repair. But when we do that consistently, we actually expand our child's window of tolerance for the messiness and conflict that come in relationships, so that the first time their friend is mean to them, they don't think they're not no longer friends, right?
Yeah.
So it allows them to really have more relational resilience. So anyway, this attachment research is full of hopefulness. And you know, the bottom line for baby book that I wrote, which is a very different kind of book compared to the other ones that I wrote, because it's alphabetical, it's very short. Like you basically pick a topic, you flip to that, you read. You know, here are the what it is it's 65 topics that we get the most competing information about.
Okay.
And so, like, if you're talking about sleep training or nipple confusion or co-sleeping or can you lick your kid's pacifier or do you have to disinfect it? You know, all these things, you can flip to that topic and you basically get in 3 or 4 pages, here are the main approaches or the ways people talk about this. Here's what the science says and here's the bottom line. So it's 65 topics, but what I say as the bottom line of the bottom line of the entire book is what we just talked about attachment, that really, honestly, the decisions we make for our babies and for our children, they feel so important. And yes, they're important. What we do as parents matters. But what matters more than any of the specific decisions around breastfeeding or co-sleeping or cloth diapers or childcare, even, what matters most is that we learn to trust ourselves as parents, that we learn to trust our babies and follow their leads and trust our instincts. But ultimately, what they need most from us is to show up and help them feel safe and seen and soothed and secure that we're going to see their needs and respond to them. That's the most important thing any parent can do.
And I guess I also have, and you have so much information and knowledge. I wish I can just take the information that you have and put it in my brain. I'll read your books for all that.
Yes. Nicole's
and been- I started the, I like the bottom line for baby. It's very easy to navigate. And so my plan is to just like read all the 65 topics, which I've already started. And then that way I know, like, I'll retain a lot of it, but that way I'll know, like, oh, I remember reading this, and then go back to it. And
but I had a question because I know there's always that myth that, oh, if you pick up the baby while he's always crying, then, you know, it'll show them that they can just get picked up while they're crying, right? That if you just leave them and they'll cry, they'll get over it, right? Is that like a thing? I mean, that's just like one of those wives' tales.
So on page 195, I have an entry called spoiling a baby by too much holding. Yes, that's one of the big ones. And so one perspective is that if you hold a baby or respond every time, you're going to spoil them and make them think they can manipulate you or whatever. And then perspective two is that, and this is the one that I'm going to go with and is the bottom line, that babies are not capable of manipulation. And here's, and I did my dissertation on this and I've written about it over and over. You cannot spoil a baby or a child with too much attention, too much affection, or too much responsiveness. And in fact, there's decades and decades of science. So even, and some pediatricians, especially old school pediatricians, are still telling this to parents, and it is absolutely wrong based on
science.
Decades of science. What we want to do is to be the most responsive, attuned caregivers, because that's how our babies learn that they can trust the world, that they can trust us. And when babies are stressed out and they have needs that aren't being responded to, it actually gives, they have to spend a lot of attention and energy trying to calm themselves down, trying to manage the stress. And that energy and attention could be going to exploring and learning and relaxing into their world. So here's the thing. Like I said, you can never, ever spoil a baby or a child by too much responsiveness, too much touching, too much holding, right? Where spoiling can come in, or let me back up for 1 second. And this is a huge discipline myth. One myth is that you either have to be like strict and have boundaries and have rules, or you can be warm and connected and loving. But the science, again, decades and decades say that actually having both is super important. It's the most effective. And that is that we're going to have boundaries and limits and rules and expectations. And those, we're going to be high in those areas, right? Mm-hmm. And we're going to also be really high on empathy and connection and relationship. And when we have boundaries and limits that we also bring empathy and connection to, it makes our children so much less reactive, which then primes their brain to be able to learn what we're trying to teach them and the skills that help them do better over time. And it also lets them know that we can handle their big feelings and that we trust that they can handle negative feelings. So let me just give a really quick example. So my little guy, JP, was, and I have permission to tell the stories that I tell about my kids.
Okay.
my kids. So one time my little guy, JP, was 4 years old and he was really tired and I knew it was going to be a difficult bath time. You know your kids and you're like, okay, I better prepare myself because this is going to be a meltdown thing. So he's in the bathtub. He's got all these Lego guys, but he's particularly upset because there's one specific Lego guy that is not in the tub with him. And the older brother does not want that particular Lego guy to get wet. And he's being very generous about letting JP play with all the other Lego guys. So I want to respect Luke's boundary. So I say to JP, you know, that guy's not going to be in the bathtub tonight. And he just becomes more and more tantrumy, right? He just has this meltdown and yelling and screaming. And this is not even my real bath. I'm not even taking a bath right now, even though he's actually in the bath. So he's using all this kind of wonky logic. Anyway, so I say to him, JP, it's time to get out of the tub. And he says, I'm not getting out. And he splashes me and yells at me. Now, in that moment, what I want to do is say, you know what? If you're going to act that way, I'm not reading bedtime stories to you to you tonight. And I don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
Okay. But the problem with the first one is, you know, threatening him with consequences that aren't going to, if I don't read to him, we're going to have an even worse bedtime. I'm punishing myself. It's going to do nothing to teach him any skills. It's just going to be a lose-lose. And to say, I don't want to hear it. When we tell our children, I don't want to hear it, they internalize that. And that's actually the opposite of what we want our children to feel. If we keep saying that, we're going to stop hearing it and they won't come to us for stuff. So instead, I take a big, deep breath and I say to myself what I know from the attachment science, which is at his worst, that is when he needs you the most. And if you want to be the calm in his storm, you cannot be the storm. So here I go, right? So I hold my boundary. I say to him, you can either get out or I will help you get out. And he says, I'm not getting out. And so as I lift him out of the tub, I'm holding my boundary. It's time to get out.
Yeah.
As I'm lifting him out of the tub, I say, you're so mad about bath time being over. You really wanted to play with that guy and you're so, so angry about it. I know, honey. I hear that. So I'm giving him lots of empathy, connection, relationship.
Yeah.
And I wrap the towel around him and I say, if you need to cry for a little while, I'm right here with you. And when kids have repeated experiences like that, he learned, like, I trust that he can feel his feelings and get through it. That's how resilience is built. Mm-hmm. You know, the difference between adversity and negative feelings and hard things that happen to us, making us fragile or making us resilient, is walking through it with enough support. And I'm also communicating to him, I can handle your big feelings. You don't have to protect me. I am the strong protector. I've got this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think those kind of moments, you know, where we hold our boundaries and rules and limits and boundaries help our children feel safe because they're predictable. So being emotionally responsive and connected and giving our children empathy and sitting with their feelings does not mean we're permissive.
Yeah.
We're not spoiling them. Where we can get into trouble with spoiling is if we don't have limits and boundaries and we say yes to every little whim and desire they have and we fix every little problem we have. That's where it becomes problematic, but not when it comes to being responsive, affectionate, and really showing up for them, especially when they're in distress.
I like that, that way of going about it, that because every how Michael Scott would say, it's a win-win-win.
Yes, it's a win for you, it's a win for your child, and it's a win for the relationship.
Exactly. And so then this goes into another question that I have. Doing all those things that you're talking about, but with a young child that is now learning to make decisions and do things, allowing them to fail, knowing that they're going to fail at something, right? But allowing them to get to that point to say, Oh, yeah, they're about to do that thing. As long as they're not going to seriously hurt themselves, but let them fall off that bike one more time. It's low to the ground. They might be in the grass or something.
Yep.
Or do this, that, and the third that you're like, okay.
Even lose in a board game.
Make a bad decision that's not obviously going to affect their health or well-being, but it'll make them learn to lose or learn to mess up and try again. Like, what is your take on that?
Yeah, and, you know, in our society, we're so afraid of negative emotions, right? And so the way you get good at dealing with disappointments is by having disappointments. The way you get good at handling, losing is by getting practice handling losing, right? Mm-hmm. And again, that's where we also show up. It's so hard to lose. That doesn't feel good sometimes, does it? Right.
Yeah.
And so we really, you know, that's really what that scene that I was talking about is that we respond in a way that matches what our child's internal landscape is experiencing, right? And, you know, developmentally, you know, that's another big thing to keep in mind is that, you know, sometimes we have such high expectations, especially if kids are really verbal early or they have, you know, they're gifted in certain ways. Emotionally, that doesn't mean they're as advanced as their words allow for. And so one of the things we can think about is that, you know, we want to be thinking about developmental appropriateness as well. Like we knew some people who kept a vase out or something breakable out on the coffee table when they had tiny little toddling children, mm-hmm. because they wanted them to experience having something that they weren't allowed to touch and to practice that. And I was like, you know what? They can practice that when they're 3 and 4. Let's set ourselves up for success, right?
Yeah.
So we also want to be thinking about making sure our expectations are there. But yeah, I think, you know, it's so tempting. And especially, you know, it's an important part as parents to kind of know ourselves, right? Like I am a fixer. I am a problem solver. I like to, you know, do things well. And so when I would see my kids, my infant or my toddler struggling with something, my instinct was to rush in and help.
Yeah.
But it's so much better to hang back and mm-hmm. observe and watch our child because, you know, one of the things we know about the brain is that, you know, the brain is incredibly plastic and changeable in childhood. But one of the ways that the brain learns best is through mistakes. When we make a mistake or there's an error, our brain actually is like, oh, I have now detected an error. I might have to shift something in order to do this in a different way. So when we jump in too quickly, we're actually robbing our child of a learning experience that's really important for their brain to, you know, to really walk through in order for their brain to change. And so, yes, of course, we want to keep them safe. But beyond that, giving them a little bit more time and space. And I would also say that not just from parent to child, but between the two of you, right?
Yeah.
So I'm one of those people that I think there's better ways to do things than others. And I like things done in certain ways. And my husband and I still work on this with my husband of 27 years, you know, the way he would diaper or the way he would do things wasn't really the way I would do them. And to say, you know what, there isn't just one way. I need to let him find his way and not rush in and quote unquote fix what really doesn't need to be fixed. It's just different ways of doing. And so mm-hmm. you may find that your child has a really different personality. And, you know, the way my boys would play was very foreign to me. And, you know, they would, even though we didn't have any kind of toy guns, they would chew their grilled cheeses into guns. And, you know, I bought like a baby doll. I had these boys, so I wanted to buy lots of different kinds of toys. And like, I bought them baby dolls and they would like smash their heads in door jams. And, you know, I was like, who are these people? Like the way you're playing is so alien to me, right? But really just going, okay, I'm going to, and you know what, here's one of my favorite things that as a parent has been so powerful for me. Dr. Michael Thompson, who has written a number of books, he wrote a book called It's a Boy. And it's really probably one of the books that I've turned to repeatedly the most during the raising of my boys. And one of the messages he gives really in all of his books is that we should really trust development. And what I mean by that is a lot of the things that we get worried about, like, oh no, my kid is, you know, she keeps making that same mistake. Like, what's wrong with her? Or, you know, gosh, she's so immature, and other kids don't seem like they're having, you know, meltdowns. Of course the other kids are, you're just not seeing it as much because kids fall apart with their parents more than anyone else, is to go, you know what? I'm going to trust that as my child's brain develops, all of this stuff's going to come online. And that even if we don't, I mean, this is, I have these parenting groups that I teach on Friday mornings that are just called office hours, where parents just ask questions and I just answer questions. And one of the things I say all the time is, you know, whatever the question is that comes up, I say, even if you don't do anything about this, your child will get better at fighting less with their siblings. Your child will get better at regulating their attention in the classroom. You know, all of these things, your kid will get better at it just because their brain is developing and it's not all on you, you know?
Yeah.
Of course, the experiences we provide are important, but we really can just watch development unfold and celebrate this amazing brain that does a lot of the work for us.
And so, you, again, you're a wealth of knowledge. I am.
I've been doing this a long time.
I can tell.
As I mentioned to you, my oldest is 21. And so I've been in the trenches for 21 years. I'm also a nerd and I read everything I can get my hands on about all of this.
Well, that's awesome because we need people like you. And so for obviously baby in Nicole's stomach, their brain is developing too. His brain.
Yes. Yes.
So should I be playing Mozart? Should I be trying to, you know, speak to him in 5 different languages? Like what should I be doing right now?
You should be talking to him and singing through Nicole's belly. We, you know, and there's an entry on this in the bottom line for baby as well. Music. Research shows that music improves kids' intelligence by introducing them to rhythms and rhymes and patterns. But really the big part right now is getting to know your voice.
Okay.
And so that's the big thing. The other thing is, and Nicole, you can thank me for this later. I promise she didn't message me on the side, is regulating Nicole's states of stress and making her the least stressed possible because we know that high levels of stress.
She's giving me the eyeball right now.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate
High levels of stress cortisol can cross the placenta. So we want to really relax, chill, safe mom. That's an important piece of that. I think just reading and, you know, Nicole, I'm glad you said you were already reading through the bottom line for baby. There's a couple of things I would encourage. I mean, first of all, it should go in everybody's go bag because there are decisions, if you're having a hospital birth, there are decisions you're going to have to make in the hospital that you don't know you're going to have to make. Like, do you give your baby their first bath at the hospital or do you wait a few days, right? Mm-hmm. So that's all in. But I think now is a beautiful time while y'all have time to start thinking about where are we going to differ in our approaches to things, right? So you guys can read these entries and say, like, you guys are having a boy. So, you know, there's a whole section on circumcision. Are you both on the same? I'm not asking you. I'm saying.
yes. I understand what you're saying.
Are we on the same page about this or not? What about discipline? You know, and how did your parents discipline you in ways that felt good or that didn't? I've got a whole entry in here on discipline too. And just thinking about, you know, the way you start responding to your infant, really that first year is really sort of trench work for you all to start building your philosophy around how you want to handle discipline. So I think it's a beautiful time now to start talking about what your parents did that you would want to emulate and what things you'd want to do differently and what areas you guys differ. And I think, you know, like my husband and I have really different risk tolerance thresholds.
Yeah.
My husband has a massive risk tolerance and I don't at all. And so we have to, you know, navigate that. And the important thing to know too is that you all don't have to be on the same page. Mm-hmm. You really just sort of want to be in the same book or chapter and really be able to communicate with each other. And so I think, you know, that would be the other thing, Victor, is just really, really just trying to have conversations about where you guys think you now is such an important formative time to think about who, you know, the parents we want to be.
Yeah.
You know, certainly you can't anticipate everything, And I'll say one other thing, if you don't mind, you haven't even asked, but I just want to give you advice based on personal experience, is that, as you know, I've had three children, and the transition to one was the very hardest for me. I spent all my growing up years babysitting, being around babies. I could not wait. My whole goal in life was to be a stay-at-home mom. And I was able to be a stay-at-home until my baby went to kindergarten, which is when the whole brain child came out and my life really changed. Mm-hmm. But what I would say is that the hardest part of the transition was my husband and I, who had been married for 6 years already by that point, we were miserable with each other and we had never had a ton of conflict. And my husband one day said, "You know what I think is happening?" And I was like, "I don't care. I don't want to talk to you." And he said, "I think we're competing with each other for who has it worse." And what was happening is, you know, he would say, "God, I'm so tired." And I would be like, "Are you effing kidding me? You're so tired. Like, I'm nursing every 3 hours." Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were really competing with each other for how miserable we were. We were trying to have a misery competition. And he said, "We're on the same team. It's this kid. It's this kid. We got to, you know, we got to be on the same team. We got to have each other's back because he's, you know, he's making things hard on us." And then we laughed about it. And just that recognition made a huge shift in what was happening between us, and we could really start supporting each other. And so I think that's the other thing too, is to just keep in mind that, you know, your relationship is still a super important mm-hmm. part of what's going on. And the other thing too is, for some reason, we all think that we can maintain the same kind of life and lifestyle we had pre-baby. Like, if you guys like having your house a certain way and like spending your time a certain way, it's impossible to do those things in the same way once you have a baby. And so to really be able to let go of some expectations, make some shifts, know that each stage feels like forever, but it does go quickly. And you'll be, you know, parenting just requires a lot of flexibility and remapping what your lives look like in different stages.
Well,
thank you so much for that advice. That's great.
That was much needed that I didn't even know I needed. So I appreciate that. And Tina, I really appreciate you coming on mm-hmm. the show and talking with us. Can you go through where people can find you on your social media and the books Absolutely. That you've written and all that stuff? Website maybe?
Yes, my website is tinabryson.com, and that's BRYSON. And you can find me across all social media as Tina Payne Bryson. The place I'm posting the most right now is on Instagram. And there's tons of free content on my website. All of the books that I've written with Dan Siegel and The Bottom Line for Baby, which is my first solo, are in audio form. But I've also, there are tons of free videos and all kinds of content on my website. And for the two of you, I'm on speed dial. So if you have Aww. Questions that come up, you know how to find me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tina. We really appreciate you and we wish you the best.
Yes. Best of luck. Best of luck to you all. I'm so excited for you and the journey ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. You have a good one.
Thanks. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was such a great conversation. And my favorite thing that she said is that you can't spoil your baby with too much love.
That was interesting. I didn't know that. I mean, people say that all the time. That's why I asked.
Yeah, like, oh, you're spoiling him by holding him all the time.
Just leave him. He'll cry it out, you know.
I'm so happy that I have a comeback for that now. I'm prepared.
The like, doctor said.
Like, no, research and studies show for the past 50 years, da-da-da-da-da. Like, I'm just going to go off because...
And it really does go back to that attachment thing, mm-hmm. you know, like if you, the more you don't do, the more you just leave them, the more they're just going to be like, what the heck?
That's heartbreaking. Yeah, that's literally heartbreaking. And I think that I know that's why I made really good decisions growing up. Like I was so honest with my parents. I never lied. And I'm just like, what the heck? Like I want my mom to raise my baby. So he turns out like that when I'm thinking, but now I realize she was always someone I could go to, mm-hmm. never judged me and always was there as like great feedback. And so that's what you and I will definitely be for our baby.
Absolutely.
Not yelling at him for little things that we can.
Yeah. And I like how she was also saying like the establishing those boundaries,
right?
Like you still tell him, you're still telling him no, but you're just dealing with it a different way opposed to like, you're not going to get your bedtime story. And you're not going to get that.
Like threatening them. You like just, you don't want to threaten
them. You pick them up because you're not doing that thing. You're not going to mm-hmm. get that thing. I'll pick you up and it sucks and I'm here with you so you can get those emotions out, mm-hmm. but you're still not getting that thing.
Right.
right? So I think that that's a really good way to go about it. But
yeah,
at the same time, everybody has their own parenting style.
Yeah, for sure.
Nobody is wrong. This is just advice to get you there.
And all the people, I'm just going to say this now, all the people on the internet are going to be telling me I know how to raise my baby. So I'm going to have all the research done so I can just be like, nope.
Well, and at the same time, that's what I think the biggest advice that I've gotten from people that have kids, is don't listen to anybody else. Like, don't let anybody else tell you that what you're doing is wrong, right? Like, there is science and all that, and that's great, but just because somebody's doing it different doesn't mean that it's wrong. So nobody has a right to tell you, obviously, unless you're threatening the life of your child.
But now, it bugs me, like, if I know somebody who's letting their child cry it out, like, I just want to say, like, that's not, like,
So there's a difference between telling them what to do educating them about it.
Oh, like, hey, this is a book that I found really
interesting. That's the way to
Here's a copy of it. And because I didn't know, there's ways.
There's ways to do it opposed to being like, hey, you can't do that. You shouldn't do that to your
kids. I do that with my animals already, so I'm so scared. Like, don't push my dog like that, or don't do that to my dog. People say something to my baby, don't you dare say that to my baby. Nobody can yell at my kid. Like, I know that for sure. But anyways, yes, we're all different and have our own styles, and I'll respect that. So. So
yeah, please, guys, we hope you enjoyed. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. The easiest way is on the little purple app on your phone, which is Apple Podcasts, or you can just go online, Apple Podcasts, and you can check us out there. And you can listen to this anywhere you listen to your podcast, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, and you can always go to www.cococalientepodcast.com, and you can also check out our merchandise there. Don't forget to follow us at Coco Caliente Podcast on Instagram and at Coco Caliente Pod on Twitter.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
If you want to be the most interesting person at the cocktail party, well, hop on over and listen to the Brain Candy Podcast.
Our award-winning content will have you laughing while you're learning.
We read all the best articles, books, and studies, and keep up with new TV shows, documentaries, and pop culture. And then we cram it all into two shows a week.
Conspiracy theories, cannibal rabbits, unsolved mysteries, the history of the Walkman. There's something for everyone.
The Brain Candy Podcast. Find our link in the show notes.
Or simply search for the Brain Candy Podcast on your podcast app.